Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on WEAA 80.9 FM, the voice of the community, your source for cool jazz and more. And we are going to tackle a subject that we looked at some time ago, a few weeks back, when I ran a panel for the Jobs Opportunity Task Force, looking at the issue of our education system and tuition and accessibility and issues facing young people we don't really talk about enough. So one of the women on the panel is joining us, and that's Dr. Sarah Goldrick-Robb, who is a professor of higher education, policy, and sociology at Temple University, founder of Wisconsin Hope Lab, which is a phenomenal thing to talk about as well, author of Paying the Price, College Cost Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. Sarah, good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me today.
And Karen York is in the studio with us. She's Director of Policy and Strategic Partnerships with the Job Opportunity Task Force. And Karen, always good to have you around. Good to see you.
Always a pleasure to be here, Mark. Thank you.
So let's just dive into it. I think that this is an area, Sarah, that when we talk about college tuition and we talk about what young people face in getting through school, that we don't really understand the depth of it. What's, you know, the entire crisis that many people find themselves in. You know, you always see these stats that black students or students at HBCUs or other places, they take 10 years to graduate, they never graduate, they have a horrible graduation record, and they leave this stat hanging out there as if something's wrong with somebody, as opposed
well,
to understanding.
Well, that's exactly right.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly right. It's usually described like this is a narrow problem affecting some people with perhaps personal challenges. And that's just not the case. The numbers nationally and the studies across the country clearly indicate that there is a crisis of college pricing that's affecting everyone. And it's across institutions, it's at all kinds of schools. It's even at elite schools where the wealthiest people tend to go to college. And it really is challenging students who are just trying to earn degrees. They're having such great difficulties making ends meet that it can be hard to even survive. We spend a lot of time talking about tuition, for example, when tuition is less than half of what students are having to pay for college, and their real challenge is with things like rent and food. And yet we don't talk about those things even while students are going hungry. So yeah, we're really overlooking, I think, a major, major issue.
And I some of it's political. And Karen, talk a bit about the work that you're doing around this.
Sure. So, you know, everything that Sarah said is correct in terms of, you know, when we think of access and affordability to higher education, we tend to focus just on tuition and how much it actually costs to be admitted, and not really focus on what it takes to actually live while matriculating through the system. And so the population that the Job Opportunity Task Force represents are those individuals who are either, who pretty much are going back to school because they either need to obtain a basic degree or certification of some level to be able to access the workforce, and or they are going back to they're going back to school so that they can register for an occupational course that may not necessarily be a credit course, but it would greatly assist in them being able to obtain higher wages or better positions in the workplace. And so there are a number of issues that we've worked on over the years around increasing access and affordability for those adult workers that are seeking to go back to school to obtain higher wages or to enter the workforce. And so there are a number of bills that I can talk about. I have three major bills that would love the support of your listeners and would greatly assist in this process. The first one is actually being sponsored by Delegate Shelley Hettleman. It's House Bill 509. And this is a bill, you know, the short and skinny is this bill would provide another key in the toolbox to ensure that students are making the best educational and financial choices. And this bill would require Maryland higher educational institutions that receive state financial aid or that receive state aid to provide annual info to students regarding potential college debt. So we're talking about providing information regarding the student's total amount of federal educational loans, the range of payoff amount, the monthly payment estimates, both principal and interest, financial aid counseling resources, and a number of other things. And the reason reason why this is so important is because students just don't know what they're borrowing and how much they're borrowing. And so you find that there was a 2014 Brookings study that found that 28% of student borrowers have no clue that they even took out federal educational loans. And 14% just had no clue that they had any student loan debt at all. So again, this is just another tool in the toolbox to ensure that students are making the best educational and financial decisions. Another bill I spoke about, those workers going back to school to check into those courses that might not necessarily be credit courses, but they assist in getting better wages and jobs. One bill would require the state to set aside $2 million, a workforce sequence grant, so that those individuals that are applying for occupational non-credit courses, they can access those funds, because we know those individuals that are trying to access courses at community colleges, sometimes costs can be a barrier, and so this will provide assistance to them. And the last one is a biggie. We've heard about Ban the Box on job applications. This is the idea that you have to check a box indicating that you've been arrested or convicted of a crime in order to obtain an interview or the like.
Right.
We're now looking at banning the box on college applications. California has done it. New York just did it. And so we want Maryland to be the next state. We do not believe that if you are trying to get a college education, that you should have to check a box. Your criminal background should not be a determining factor as to whether or not you can obtain an education. So, you know, Delegate McIntosh and Delegate Barron, and on the Senate side, Senator Joan Carter Conway have introduced the Maryland Fair Access to Education Act of 2017. This is a huge priority of JOTF's, and this would eliminate the arrest conviction question from the applications for all Maryland colleges and institutions.
So I do want to come back to the state piece, because I see
absolutely
how it fits in, because as we kind of talk about this broad issue, pushing it here on a local level is really important. And I do want to get into the politics of this, because let me ask you this question, Sarah. I was going to go talk about some of the stuff with your study that led to your book. Before I get to that, given what Karen just raised, I mean, what can you give us a sense of the spectrum of the political issues and the battle going on in states around the country around this, and what maybe a national push is, and what the other, and how this correlates to things happening in other states?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, first, I think it's important to know that one of the main political issues at the heart of all of these discussions is an unresolved question of who should get to go to college. You know, the economy makes one argument, which is, frankly, that most people ought to be going to college. You know, it's certainly clear that if you don't go to college, your chances of earning a decent living and having stable employment are greatly reduced. But on the other hand, it seems as though some people feel strongly that while their own children need to go to college, other people's children don't need to, or at least don't deserve our help in doing so. And so you do see policies being discussed around the country that would frankly inhibit access to higher education for a whole variety of groups. Some of these debates are things like, you know, should people who did have an incident, of some kind of juvenile delinquency as a child,
right,
have access to college? Other questions are things like, should children who have grown up in our country and gone to school in this country, but nonetheless don't have documentation, should they be able to get access to tuition? The other big question is, if we have limited resources for financial aid, should we try to make sure that only the poorest people get those monies, or should we include the middle class in our efforts to lower prices? And all of these might sound like discussions on which we can just use numbers to make decisions, but in fact, that's not the case. These things represent values, and they are very heated political topics.
I mean, it seems to me that's part of the political nature of this, before we get into some of the specifics of people's lives and how this affects folks and what you learned in your studies. But it seems to me this is the political aspect of this is something you concluded with, which is that we isolate things to say this is only a problem in the black community, even though it's exacerbated if you're young and black and working class or poor and trying to get through school because of racism and all the rest in this country. That's very clear. But it's not just a black problem, and it's not just a problem
of
poor kids. It's a problem of middle-class families and working-class families all across America trying to get their kids through school and kids trying to figure out how to get through school. That's, I think, really an important point here.
Yeah, it really is. And I, you know, I want your readers to know and your listeners to know that you know, my study wasn't set in Baltimore. My study, in the initial part of the work that I've done on this, and I've certainly gone beyond it now, but it was set in Wisconsin. Okay, it was set in what many people consider flyover country, and it's a very, very white state. And in fact, since that was the case, I decided in the book to explore this question of whether, for example, all these people on the so-called Dole, the Pell Grant program, whether these folks were in fact really people of color. Guess what? They're not. Just as in the case with so many social programs, the vast majority of recipients are white. And they actually look a lot like the children of many of our legislators. You know, they many of them did grow up in two-parent homes. Many of them do have parents who are employed. Nonetheless, the price of college is so high, and it is so hard to get ahead in this country, that even, quote-unquote, regular folks have trouble making ends meet. And that fact needs to become more widely known so that people can stop pretending, again, like this is an isolated concern. It's happening in the Midwest. It's happening in the South. It's happening on both coasts. And that means, to me, that we need to take much broader and bigger action to fix problems that are pervasive and are really undermining the country.
You know, just to piggyback on what Sarah said, you know, Mark, I think it's really important to highlight that, yes, these issues are not specific to urban areas and urban areas where there are predominantly people of color, because you also find that these conversations are not just happening amongst educational groups. You're finding that these issues are now key workforce issues. That's why it's risen to the top of JOTF's priority list. We now have business leaders that are coming to us saying, we need a qualified workforce, and a qualified workforce means an educated workforce. And if we have barriers to education for individuals with criminal records, if we have barriers to education for individuals who can't even afford to access or to pay for, you know, tuition at a community college and be able, you know, to pay for rent, child support, or if their car just happens to get towed, we know what that does to someone's budget. These are the things that are very disruptive to a worker's life, and it really disrupts whether or not, going back to access, individuals can even access the workforce and then be able to move up in the workforce so that they can support themselves and their family. So it's not just an urban issue. It's not just a black issue, but it's also not just an educational issue. It's really, truly, at least in Maryland, has become a workforce issue.
I think one of the things that's really important to this, and I think, Sarah, you touched on it as well, is that these are the kind of things that I think are really critical, given the stage we're in this country, to show people they have things to unite around when it comes to building a stronger country and giving people the rights they have for education and building a life. I mean, this is fundamental. I mean, we have to remember, there's no constitutional guarantee to an education in America.
No, but, certainly not at the federal level.
Right.
It's a state level,
state level.
At the state level, state constitutions are guaranteeing this, and many of them, I think, it could be interpreted, in fact, to actually guarantee the right to the 13th and 14th years, given that it is almost impossible to have a decent life in this country if you don't go beyond high school. But you're right, this is so important for this country, and it's partly about unity, but it's also just about what happens when people don't feel like there are opportunities for them. A lot of the anger and resentment that we're seeing all over the country right now is stemming from a sense that you just can't get ahead anymore, that you can't get a job that you can keep, that you can't get the education that you know you need, that blocked opportunities are in the way and they're very demoralizing. And there's a lot of research on what happens to children when they don't see opportunities in their future. And I think that's the real reason to worry about this and do something right now, which is that when children grow up with a sense that, for example, college is not affordable, and there's research on exactly this, they are more likely to withdraw from school, to not take hard classes, to even be more likely to get involved in criminal activity. They're even somewhat more likely to get pregnant as teenagers. And it's because they don't see the point of sticking to the right path anymore. There's nothing for them. And this message that's being sent all over the place is that the country is just so broken. We have to try to make it great again and everything. This is telling people that we're just so wrong. What would be the point of people behaving in good ways? You know, so in other words, fixing these issues at a policy level, even in something as so narrow as higher education policy, it could have some really good spillover effects, even for our youth.
So why do we think it's so invisible to America? It's not invisible to the people who are living through it and suffering through it. And people who are trying to wrestle with this, and why do we think it's so invisible as a subject? It's part of your work, both your works, actually it's part of your life's work in what you do as a teacher, as an activist. But you know, it's not one of those things that's bubbling up to the surface as the issue. I mean, Bernie Sanders tried to raise some similar issues, but I mean, why do you think it's so invisible?
One reason is that people don't tend to think about these challenges of paying for college until they're actually paying for college. And that's a problem, because the period of time in which they're paying for college is a very limited number of years of their lives. So what I hear from parents of young children is they've got enough to worry about. They've got to worry about paying for preschool. They've got to worry about childcare. They've got to worry about the quality of their K-12 system. There's more activism on those issues. And what they're doing as far as college is first worrying, which is legitimate, and second is trying to save for school. Neither of those things, worrying or saving, is going to make college more affordable for them. You can't save your way out of this one. Very few people have that kind of money. And then there's this other group. They're past college, right? They may not have even gotten a college education, but they're past the age at which they thought they would, or they got a college education decades ago. And frankly, they're not that interested in the topic anymore. They're just past it. And they see this as a conversation about other people's children. And because of that, because there are only a limited number of people in the immediate age range in which you'd be paying for college, I really think that it's just an easier issue to ignore. And it's very unfortunate.
Yeah, and I just want to piggyback on the first point that Sarah highlighted, not knowing about these issues until it's actually impacting you, directly impacting you, particularly when it comes to community colleges. We find that a lot of adult workers that find out, okay, I can obtain this higher wages if I go take this course at the local community college. And then they go to register and they find out how much it is per credit. And that right there just stops the process, because they're like, listen, I'm coming here to make more money, and yet you're asking me for all of this money so that I can take this course so that I can make more money. So that in and of itself is, you know, a huge barrier for them. And I think that you're finding that even policymakers don't realize how much cost at community colleges are to individuals. I mean, we see nationwide this focus on the use and the utility of community colleges for workers and for those that are trying to re-enter society. But no one, at least at the level that it should be occurring, is talking about the cost of community college and how community college should be, in terms of access, you know, should be, you know, the one entity that's the easiest, the one educational entity that's the easiest to access, because it's supposed to be targeted towards that non-traditional student. And so if we're finding in those, you know, jurisdictions or those areas where, you know, for instance, Baltimore City, I mean, we could have a whole, we could do a whole show just on Baltimore City Community College alone. But in Baltimore City, there's such a need for a strong, stable community college. And yet even those courses, even the cost of the courses that do exist, are barriers to individuals. And particularly, and just going back to the bill that I mentioned earlier, particularly if state financial aid is not available for non-credit courses.
So, I mean, let's explore that for a minute, for just a bit more, because there's a bunch of issues I'll make sure we get through before the end of the hour. But what do you mean? But let's describe these non-credit courses and why they're so critical.
Sure. So the state office, the Office of State Financial Assistance, of course, they provide financial assistance to a number of programs.
And what would be a non-credit course you're talking about?
So an occupational course. So say, for instance, you know, I want to take carpentry, right? I'm trying to get a job down at, I don't know, I'm a construction worker, and I'm trying to, you know, instead of going to one of the for-profit schools, I decide that I want to use I want to use my local community college. Don't even get me started on the for-profit schools and how, you know, you pay all this money and you take, now you can take out loans for that one, but then you have a, you know, certificate that means absolutely nothing. But anyway, so I decide that I want to, you know, go to my local community college and take a course on, you know, carpentry or plumbing, so that, you know, that certification will allow me to obtain a better position or a higher wage. I find that, let's say per credit, it's a 4-credit course, but per credit, it's, you know, $170 per credit. And then I have to take into account any clinics or, you know, any fees or any tools or any things of that nature. So now I'm looking at a number that's largely that's largely a barrier to me being able to access this course. And so state financial aid, unfortunately, because it's a non-credit course, if it's a non-credit course, it is not eligible for financial aid, unfortunately. So if you're going to say for instance, intro to mathematics, if you're taking intro to mathematics and it's 4 credits, that course would be eligible for state financial aid, because they view that as moving towards an actual degree. But a non-credit course that might not necessarily be 4 credits, but be 4, you know, let's say points or whatever the credentialing is in that particular industry, it's not moving towards a degree, but it's moving towards an actual position or a higher wage, is not eligible for state financial aid.
And this issue is one of the reasons why the average person making $30,000 or less who enrolls at Baltimore pays out of pocket after all financial aid, if they are lucky enough to get it, $7,300.
Wow.
Okay, that's the theory that I think a lot of people are walking around with is that person making $30,000 or less must be paying nothing for community college.
Mm-hmm.
But the out-of-pocket after all financial aid is $7,300, and it goes up exponentially from there. I mean, if you're, you know, making, say, 48 to 75, it's going to be over $10,000 a year. These prices were not this high in the past. They really have gone up substantially. And it happened at a time when, as we all know, people are not exactly getting ahead in Baltimore,
mm-hmm.
making more and more money year after year.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very critical subject for all of us. We're going to come back to the national implications, look at the local implications, so we're not going anywhere. Don't you go anywhere. We'll come right back here on the Mark Steiner Show in just 1 second, well, maybe a couple minutes, but we'll be right back with Karen York, Director of Policy and Strategic Partnerships, the Job Opportunity Task Force, and Dr. Sarah Goldrick-Rodd, who is a professor of higher education, policy, and sociology at Temple University, founder of Wisconsin Hope Lab, author of Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. Stay with us. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. So welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're exploring this hour the issue of colleges and how difficult it is for so many families and people to get through college and pay for it, whether it's the issue of financial aid, who gets it, who doesn't get it, how much states and cities are willing to put in, and colleges are even willing to put into this. Looking at the issue, as one of our guests, Dr. Sarah Goldberg-Rabb, said, which was that this not just tuition, that's only half or less than half the cost that young people have to worry about and people have to worry about getting through school. We're here with her, Dr. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, who is professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, founder of the Wisconsin Hope Lab, author of Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream, and Karen York, who is director of policy and strategic partnerships with Job Opportunity Task Force. So picking up on this question of economics for a moment, the last thing you just said. Right? You can both pick up on this. So what are the politics and economics that are blocking, A, an understanding of this, but B, real legislation that deals with this and addresses the problem? I mean, what are the political forces arrayed here?
Right. So,
I'm sorry. You go ahead.
Thanks. I mentioned earlier in my comments that we're finding that you have a lot of business leaders and business groups that are interested in how to increase access to education for the purposes of ensuring a more qualified, educated workforce. And we know in the state of Maryland, we have a Republican governor, Governor Hogan, who is very business friendly and wanting to ensure that, you know, businesses are moving into the state, staying in the state, and hiring state residents. So there's a lot of support from the administration for what businesses feel that they need to get business done in the state. However, when it comes to something, I would be remiss if I also did not note the governor's interest in supporting community colleges as a vehicle for being able to access the workforce or matriculate up through the workforce. However, given all of that, given, you know, a strong interest and passion and focus on wanting to increase access to jobs and ensure that businesses have access to educated, qualified workers and ensure that community colleges are truly, you know, the educational institutions that are available for those workers and that need it and businesses that need to provide curriculums to create a qualified workforce, you find that, you know, with the legislation that would require the state to set aside $2 million specifically to community colleges so that those individuals who need to access non-credit courses at community colleges for purposes of workforce, In our current political environment, unfortunately, that great idea in the business circles, in the workforce circles, in Annapolis, unfortunately, is now looked at as a mandate. It's the state, the governor is required to set aside this money. It's almost looked at as a Democratic mandate. And we all know that given the current climate, whether you're in Annapolis or D.C., that's not a good look. And so our sponsors, you know, on the Senate side, we have Senator Kathy Klossmeyer, Baltimore County, you know, moderate Democrat. And on the House side, we have Delegate Adrian Jones from Baltimore County, who's the Speaker pro tem. But still, because there's a dollar amount, that $2 million, and it's a workforce bill. It's $2 million specifically for community colleges for things called workforce sequence grants, so that if you are trying to, you know, register for a course that would allow you to enter the workforce or access better jobs or wages, financial aid, that $2 million would not be appropriated to provide financial aid for those individuals because it's a mandate. So political environment, is totally muddy in the waters in terms of, you know, issues that are bringing together, you know, education advocates, workforce advocates, business leaders, policymakers, you know, in Baltimore and all across the state at boardrooms and in conference rooms is bringing folks together. But unfortunately, when it comes to, you know, the halls of Annapolis, it comes down to whether or not it's a mandate.
And is the governor supported or not?
We've reached out to the governor. I think they are waiting to see what happens with the legislation. But as I mentioned, they've already indicated they're not supporting any mandates. And so since the governor having to appropriate $2 million for this program, to them would appear as if it's a mandate. I'm not sure if the governor would be supporting this. So if it were to pass both the House and the Senate, I would not be shocked if there was talk of a veto.
That's a bunch of things here. Now, one of the things I'm looking at in the news, when you see, and I'm reading news from around the country, that we have two states, Tennessee and Oregon, that now offer free tuition for two-year colleges. New York State is now pursuing this idea of launching a new plan to pay for college for two- and four-year students, for in-state students. So, I mean, what is the reality politically of what those things, do they work? What are they costing those states, and what can we learn from them?
Well, first, you know, what's happening in each of those states is a bit different, and that's important. It should be associated with their context. And in every case, while we could say that community college is free, for example, it's only free for a limited number of people. I think that's normal and fine, frankly, because you have to start somewhere. Now, in Tennessee, it's important to know that this is a Republican governor who has led this effort. But before we dismiss it, we should acknowledge that President Obama thought it was a good idea, and he tried to introduce it at the federal level. What they have done there is to make community college free for some recent high school graduates who tend to be younger. Now, they also just introduced a plan to expand that to older students, which is something a lot of people wanted to see because it's oftentimes the older students who actually face the bigger financial constraints. And so those that were criticizing the Tennessee governor for focusing on younger folks are now having to back off because, as we expected, he's doing one thing at a time. Now, he's financing his plan in a regressive way because he's using the lottery. And lotteries are disproportionately funded by lower-income people.
Right.
In Oregon, however, in Oregon, they funded it through the legislature with an appropriation of $10 million. Now, admittedly, they're struggling to continue to reauthorize that appropriation year after year, and that makes sense. But, of course, it's always hard to come up with the money. But they did a more progressive model that also guaranteed low-income students at least another $1,000 of discount so that everybody's getting something. In New York State, again, they're talking about using appropriation. There are some people are saying, it doesn't look like it costs enough. Other people are saying, it looks like it costs too much. My question is, what's the right number? And what number would be too high to invest in higher education for a state citizen that need it so badly? I mean, it's so clear that the returns to college are so robust for a state. What number is so high that it would be too expensive? We don't actually know these things.
So, I mean, this is, you know, in some ways, I think, uncharted territory for a lot of people politically. And it's, it's the work you've been doing, Sarah, and others have been working, have pushed this to the forefront in discussions with people because of the work you've been doing. And I think Bernie Sanders pushed it to the forefront because of his demand during the primary Democratic primary campaign, where he kind of forced Hillary Clinton to even think about how to help families through college. So I think it's an interesting moment we're in this kind of populist uproar. Now I'm wondering one more political question before we come right back to the heart of the nature of what we've been talking about, which is we now have this the potential of Betty DeVos as being the new Secretary of Education. And even though we've seen this populist wave from the right, but a populist wave that put this person into the White House. That Betty DeVos is anything but a populist or somebody who has ever fought education for the needs of poor people, working class people, middle class people, or public education as a whole. So what does that portend for the national debate, do we think?
Yeah, this is not good. And frankly, I could be on either political side and oppose this nominee, simply because she literally knows nothing about educational policy. And she revealed this not only in the televised question and answer period that you could watch, but also in the more than 100 written questions, I think it's actually closer to 1,000 questions, that she had to respond to. I have reviewed the answers to these questions in all of my areas of expertise in higher education policy. And it is abundantly clear that she does not know very basic things. We asked her questions, for example, about how she would support homeless students who were in college. It's not clear that she knew there were homeless students in college. Okay? So it is so important that this person not be in charge of any budget or any decision-making around educational policy, and that we at least push for a nominee who has some sort of background or expertise in education.
Yeah, I mean, I've been following it fairly closely myself, and it's very frightening to see what we're about to unleash on our public school system if she is in fact installed as the new Secretary of Education. We won't get very far with this discussion in many places either, if that is the case. One thing I'm going to come back and talk a bit about, I think that does affect communities of color in some very deep ways, in not just where we're broadcasting from, but also all across the country. But there's also this bill we have in Maryland we're going to be fighting about, which is taking people's criminal history off of applications to get into college. Now that, you know, I mean, for some people that's like, well, no, no, we have to know who was coming. We got to know who they are. I got to know whether this person, you know, broke into a car and stole it before I let him in my college. Right? I mean, that's, I can hear the arguments going on. But this is an issue. I mean, this really affects, and it also doesn't legally affect your ability to get a loan sometimes. Right?
Yes. So, you know, I'm going to start, my answer with your prior question around the education secretary nominee. If she is confirmed, or I'll start with this. Before President Obama left office, he and his Department of Education issued a nationwide memo to colleges and universities urging them to remove the question from their initial application and to create a process that would better facilitate those formerly incarcerated individuals or individuals with a criminal background, better facilitate them to access an education, a higher educational institution. There were many states that quickly moved to, you know, adopt what was suggested and recommended in this memo. What we're finding now is if this is going to be the leader of our education department, we're going to see a lot of the momentum come to a startling halt. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's important for states to really ante up in terms of removing barriers to education, to jobs for our most disadvantaged individuals. You know, 1 in 3 Americans have some type of criminal record that's going to come up in a routine background check. Okay, and if we know that education is strongly correlated to income, and if we know, well, quite honestly, there were many individuals who did not know that there was a question on your college application asking you to check a box if you have ever been arrested or convicted of a crime. You have some colleges that are asking about juvenile adjudications, about your juvenile record. You are having, you know, you have some colleges and universities, and we're not just talking about your major colleges and universities. We're talking about community colleges. We're talking about for-profit colleges. We're talking about every institution that provides some sort of educational or vocational support or training asks you to check a box. And so the Job Opportunities Task Force supports what we're seeing across the nation in terms of no one should be denied access to an education. No one. It does not matter what you did in your past. No one should be denied access to an education. And even if you have those institutions that say, oh, we wouldn't deny someone an education based on their criminal record, the fact that you have that question on the initial application means that you pause when you see that box checked. And that means that you actually do take into account whether or not this individual should be admitted based on their criminal record. Now, the other side of this is, oh, you know, what about those individuals that have been, you know, charged and convicted or have records for assault and rape and attempted murder? Yes, these are very, very serious offenses. Absolutely. And higher scrutiny should be given to individuals who have these criminal records, whether they're accessing, you know, the job place or an educational institution. But two answers to that. Number one, doesn't matter what your criminal record is. You still should be able to access an education if you want one. The second answer to that is you hear a lot about this idea of the Stanford rapist, right? The recent situation where, you know, the college student in Stanford, you know, raped an unconscious female college student. And so you hear a lot of pushback about, well, what about the Stanford rapist, and how can we make sure by taking the arrest conviction question off of the initial application, how do we ensure that, you know, we're not going to get a bunch of Stanford rapists? You know, the answer to that is, first of all, the Stanford rapist wasn't the Stanford rapist when he applied to Stanford. He had been admitted, did not have a criminal record, and committed that rape. So you have individuals who don't have a criminal record that are being admitted on campus and are still engaging in violent criminal activity. So clearly, the criminal record should not be the sole determinant as to whether or not you are going to commit crimes on a college campus. And then the second thing is, just going back to the initial point, it's an education. No one should be denied the right to an education. And so this is what this is about, the Maryland Fair Access to Education Act of 2017. It's removing that question off the initial application. It's stating that once you get admitted, then the college or university can run the background check. And then based on that information, they can say, hey, you're trying to be a social worker, but you have some assault charges. As you're matriculating through the system, let's engage you in some counseling and supportive services so that we can deal with any issues that may come up when it comes time for licensure.
So,
let me, if I can, for a moment.
Go ahead.
This question's actually being hotly debated right now in Wisconsin because there was just an incident in which a student was trying to start what appears to be a white supremacist group on the college campus, and it turns out that he was convicted of a hate crime before he came to UW-Madison, and this is a white kid. Now we have the chancellor of UW-Madison suggesting that they should be looking at the criminal records of people when they are being admitted. And in fact, the entire University of Wisconsin system is utilizing the Common App, which actually does have this question on it. I agree. I think they're missing the point. Putting questions on college applications helps to deter applications in the first place. And some of those folks committed, you know, things as children and have long since, gone through processes of forgiveness and et cetera and gotten way past these things. And the education was what moved them forward. But it's also clear that if somebody committed a sexual assault, right, or if somebody committed a hate crime, then all we need to do is ensure that those crimes among current enrolled students are reported to the college so that they can attend to those students and pay attention to them. Anything else, though, regarding an application is flat-out discriminatory. But it's interesting to see even the chancellor of a progressive university or a purportedly progressive university lean in this direction, especially in this day and age.
Yep. Right. Any excuse will be used. This is a very dangerous, slippery slope we're on. I just want to say before we move on to conclude our conversation with both of you that as we were taping this conversation today, I just learned that two Republican senators, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, will vote no for Betsy DeVos. And also, CNN broke some news saying that Betsy DeVos appears to have plagiarized quotes for the Senate questionnaire that you were just referring to, Sarah. So,
yes, we did see that. I'm not sure whether those two senators, what they said in the confirmation hearing yesterday in the Health Committee was that they would approve her being allowed to be up for a vote. Oh, I do see what you're saying.
Yeah, right.
They now say they will not vote.
Right.
That's a change. Yeah, yesterday they said they couldn't. She couldn't count on it. So this is a good thing, and we need more people to bring this kind of pressure. Like I said before, we don't even need to be partisan about this, frankly. I mean, on the facts itself, she just simply isn't qualified.
So it's just interesting. As we speak, things change, and we just want to be able to get that out to everybody and to hear what we're talking about here. There are a bunch of things here. There are a couple things we can get to. It would be great before our time is out. And I think that you raised some things in your book. We've never had a chance to really talk about your book, which I want to do one day in some depth very soon. Sarah, but this is because we cover food a lot in this program. Is the food insecurity faced by a lot of people trying to go to college? We don't hear that. We don't think about it. We don't think that as part of a reality of people's lives, and also the madness of saying that there has to be a family obligation when family to when they go for this financial aid. So there are a lot of hidden pieces here that we never think about.
That's exactly right. And frankly, we're now staring down some very substantial evidence that these are very real problems. And I want to be clear for your listeners. We're not talking about people eating ramen every day. I understand that you did that during college. I understand that couch surfing was occasionally something that folks did. But we're in a situation now where we're talking about large numbers, as many as 20% at some institutions, as many as 50% at some of the nation's community colleges, going without food for even an entire day or series of days on a regular basis. And this is happening in part because the social programs that serve children who are hungry do not serve college students. So, for example, while in public schools around this country, if you come to school and you need breakfast or lunch, you can receive it for free. That does not exist, not even in the nation's community colleges. If you qualify for food stamps, you can also receive them as a child. As a college student, you cannot receive them unless you yourself have a child or you work at least 20 hours a week, which is counterproductive to your college studies and also can be difficult work to obtain. And finally, while there are food pantries often in communities around this country, they are, until recently, very rarely located on or near college campuses, which is where people are spending their time. So we have an inadequate safety net when it comes to food for college students, and people are suffering. And the same thing goes for housing. In fact, in two studies now, including one I'm about to release in a couple of weeks, we have now found estimates that indicate that 13% of the nation's community college students are, in fact, homeless. And we're using 13%. A conservative definition, 13%. That means people are sleeping in their cars, sleeping in abandoned buildings, sleeping in shelters, sleeping in sidewalks. We're not talking about merely people who can't pay their rent or utilities. Those numbers are even higher. So this really is a hidden crisis. And it is no wonder that these people cannot finish college.
That's a shocking stat.
And, you know, Sarah mentioned those group of individuals who, you know, cannot access food stamps, those college students that can't access food stamps but their children can. There are also a segment of the working population, those individuals that are also seeking to access higher education, that are recipients of food stamps. And unfortunately, they've interacted with the criminal justice system. And their interaction with the criminal justice system, unfortunately, if they were convicted of, say, a nonviolent felony drug offense, only drug offenses, then their food stamps, they become ineligible for food stamps for 1 year and must be subject to random drug tests. So you can be convicted of armed robbery and all of these things and keep your food stamps, but if you are convicted of a felony drug offense, then your food stamps are suspended. You become ineligible. So think about someone who has a strict budget for the month, and they are really relying on those food stamps to be able to cover their food costs. And they just happen to look, you know, a certain way and live in a neighborhood where all you got to do is step outside, and next thing you know, you're getting, you know, you're hit with an arrest record, and you're, you know, going through the criminal justice system. You know, that alone could disrupt your ability to obtain or to maintain food stamps. And so, you know, something like that you don't even think folks are really thinking about, that's a huge blow to their budget, and it could in turn cause them to re-engage even more with the criminal justice system.
So, I mean, this debate and this question has a lot of ramifications. I mean, to explore both in terms of the economics of budgets, we're seeing, as I think you pointed out before, Sarah, in some of the pieces you've written, that we're cutting school state higher education budgets. At the same time, tuitions are being raised and people are having a more difficult time getting through. And so what we want to do is we're going to clearly link to the stuff that's going on with the Jobs Opportunity Task Force on our website here at steinershow.org, and link to all the work that Dr. Sarah Goldrick-Robb has been working on as well. So you can access that, and we'll come back to the subject. Definitely want to come back to see where we are with the state legislature and the issues we raised here today with Karen York, and also want to come back with Dr. Goldrick Sarah Robb to talk about her book, Paying the Price, with the new reports coming out and seeing what that is. So let me thank both of our guests. Karen York is Director of Policy and Strategic Partnerships with the Job Opportunity Task Force, and Dr. Sarah Goldrick Robb is Professor of Higher Education Policy and Sociology at Temple University, founder of the Wisconsin Hope Lab, which we'll also link to on our website, and author of Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. And Karen and Sarah, thank you both so much for taking your time today.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Again, thank our guests, and I hope you enjoyed that conversation. We're going to take a short break now, but we're going to come right back. with a brand new episode of Soundbites, a weekly look at food, agriculture, our environment, and our energy systems. This week, we're focusing on the black farmer in the Eastern Shore and in America. You don't want to miss that. On our way to break, I want to remind you, it's brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From limiting overtesting to protecting public school funding, you can learn more about the issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or at SteinerShow.org is the Maryland State Education Association's website. We'll be right back right after this news break. Stay with us.